General Emilio de Bono stood at the window of his office and looked across the squalid roofs of the town of Asmara towards the great brooding massif of the Ethiopian highlands. It looked like the backbone of a dragon, he thought, and suppressed a shudder. The general was 70 years of age, so he recalled vividly the last Italian army that had ventured into the mountain fastness. The name Adawa was a dark blot on the history of Italian arms, and after 40 years that terrible bloody defeat of a modern European army was still unavenged. Now destiny had chosen him as the avenger, and Emilio de Bono was not certain that the role suited him. It would be much more to his liking if wars could be fought without anybody getting hurt. The general would go to great lengths to avoid inflicting pain or even discomfort. Orders that might be distasteful to the recipient were avoided. Operations that might place anybody in jeopardy were frowned upon severely by the commanding general and his officers, had learned not to suggest such extravagances. The general was at heart a diplomat and a politician, not a warrior. He liked to see smiling faces, so he smiled a great deal himself. He resembled a sprightly, wizened little goat, with a pointed white beard that gave him the nickname of Little Beard, and he addressed his officers as Caro, and his men as Bambino. He just wanted to be loved, so he smiled and smiled. However, the general was not smiling now. This morning he'd received from Rome another one of those importunate coded telegrams signed Benito Mussolini. The wording had been even more peremptory than usual. The King of Italy wishes, and I, Benito Mussolini, Minister of the Armed Forces, order that... Suddenly he struck himself a blow on his medal-bedecked chest, which startled Captain Crespi, his aide-de-camp. "They do not understand," cried de Bono bitterly. "It is all very beautiful to sit in Rome and urge haste, to cry strike, but they do not see the picture as we do, who stand here looking across the Mareb River at the swarming multitudes of the enemy." The captain came to the general's side, and he also stared out of the window. The building that housed the Expeditionary Army headquarters in Asmara was double-storied, and the general's office at the top floor commanded a sweeping view to the foot of the mountains. The captain observed wryly that the swarming multitudes were not readily apparent. The land was a vast emptiness, slumbering in the brilliant sunlight. Air reconnaissance in depth had described no concentrations of Ethiopian troops, and reliable intelligence reported that the Emperor Haile Selassie had ordered that none of his rudimentary military units approach the border at as close as 50 kilometres to avoid giving the Italians an excuse to march. "They do not understand that I must consolidate my position here in Eritrea, that I must have a firm base and supply train," cried de Bono pitifully. For over a year had been consolidating his position and assembling his supplies. The crude little harbour of Massawa, which once had lazily served the needs of an occasional tramp steamer or one of the little Japanese salt traders, had been reconstructed completely. Magnificent stone piers ran out into the sea, great wharves bustled with steam cranes, and busy locomotives shuttled the incredible array of warlike stores that poured ashore by the thousands of tons a day for month after month. The Suez Canal remained open to the transports of the Italian adventure, and a constant stream of them poured southwards, unaffected by the embargo that the League of Nations had declared on the importation of military materials into eastern Africa. Up to the present time, over 3 million tons of stores had been landed, and this did not include the 5,000 vehicles of war, troop transports, armoured cars, tanks and aircraft that had come ashore. To distribute this vast assembly of vehicles and stores, a road system had been constructed, fanning into the interior, a system so magnificent as to recall that of the Caesars of ancient Rome. General de Bono smote his chest again, startling his aide. "They urge me to untimely endeavour. They do not seem to realise that my force is insufficient." The force, which the general lamented was the greatest and most powerful army ever assembled on the African continent, he commanded 360,000 men, armed with the most sophisticated tools of destruction the world had yet devised. from the Caproni CA-133 three-engined monoplane, which could carry 2 tons of high explosive and poison gas, a range of 900 miles, to the most modern armoured cars and heavily armoured CV-3 tanks with their 50mm guns and supporting units of heavy artillery. This great assembly was encamped about Asmara and upon the cliffs overlooking the Mareb River. It was made up of distinct elements, the green-clad regular army formations with their wide-brimmed tropical helmets, the black-shirt fascist militia with their high boots and cross straps, their death's head and thunderbolt badges and their glittering daggers, the regular colonial units of black Somalis and Eritreans in their tall, tasseled red fezes and baggy shirts, their gaily coloured regimental sashes and puttied legs above bare feet. Lastly, the irregular volunteers or banda, who were a group of desert bandits and cutthroat cattle thieves, attracted by the possibility of war in the way that the taint of blood gathers sharks. De Bono knew, but did not ponder the fact that nearly 70 years previously, the British general, Napier, had marched on Magdala with less than 50,000 men, meeting and defeating the entire Ethiopian army on the way, storming the mountain fortress and releasing the British prisoners held there, before retiring in good order. Such heroics were outside the realms of the general's imagination. Caro, the general placed an arm about the gold-braided shoulders of his aide. We must compose a reply to the Duce. He must be made to realize my difficulties. He patted the shoulder affectionately, and his face lightened once more into its habitual expression as he began composing. My dear and respected leader, please be assured of my loyalty to you and the glorious fatherhood of Italy. The captain hastened to take up a message pad and scribble industriously. Be assured also that I never cease to toil by night and by day towards... It took almost 2 hours of creative effort before the general was satisfied with his flowery and rambling refusal to carry out his orders. Now, he ceased his pacing and smiled tenderly at the captain. Although we are not yet ready for an advance in force, it will serve to placate Il Duce if we initiate the opening phases of the southern offensive. The general's plans for the invasion, when it was finally put in hand, had been laid with as ponderous regard to detail as his earlier preparations. Historical necessity dictated that the main attack should be centred on Adawa, already a marble monument brought from Italy and engraved with the words, "The dead of Adawa avenged," with the date left open, lay amongst the huge mountains of his stores. However, the plan called for a secondary flanking attack, farther south, through one of the very few gateways to the central highlands. This was the Sadi Gorge, a narrow opening that was riven up from the desert floor, splitting like an axe stroke the precipitous mountain ranges and forming a pass through which an army might reach the plateau that reared 7,000 feet above the desert. The first phase of this plan entailed the seizure of the approaches of the Sadi Gorge, and particularly important in this dry and scalded desert would be the water supplies of the attacking army. The general crossed the floor to the large-scale map of eastern Africa which covered one wall, and he picked up the ivory pointer to touch an isolated spot in the emptiness below the mountains. "The Wells of Chaldi," he read the name aloud. "Whom shall we send?" The captain looked up from his pad and observed how the spot was surrounded by the forbidding yellow of the desert. He had been in Africa long enough to know what that meant, and there was only one person he would wish were there. "Belli," he said. "Ah," said the general. "Count Aldo Belli, the fire-eater." "The clown," said the captain. "Come, Caro," the general admonished his aide mildly. "You are too harsh. The count is a distinguished diplomat. He was for 3 years ambassador to the court of St. James in London. His family is old and noble and very rich." "He is a blowhard," said the captain stubbornly, and the general sighed. "He's a personal friend of Benito Mussolini. Il Duce is a constant guest at his castle. He has great political power." "He would be well out of harm's way at this desolate spot," said the captain. And the general sighed again. "Perhaps you are correct, Caro," Send for the good count, if you please. Captain Crespi stood on the steps of the headquarters building, beneath the portico with its imitation marble columns and the clumsily painted fresco, depicting a heroic band of heavily muscled Italians defeating heathens, ploughing the earth, harvesting the corn, and generally building an empire. The captain watched sourly as the huge Rolls-Royce, opened tourer, bumped down the dusty, potholed main street. Its headlights glared like monstrously startled eyes, and its burnished sky-blue paintwork was dulled by a light flowering of pale dust. The purchase price of this vehicle would have consumed 5 years of his service pay, which accounted for much of the captain's sourness. Count Aldo Belli, as one of the nation's great landowners and amongst the 5 most wealthy men in Italy, did not rely on the army for his transportation. The Rolls had been adapted and designed to his personal specifications by the makers. As it slid to a graceful halt beneath the portico, the captain noticed the Count's personal arms blazoned on the front door, a rampant golden wolf supporting a shield with a quartered device of scarlet and silver. The legend unfurled beneath it read, "Courage arms me." As the car stopped, a small, wiry, sun-blackened little man, in the uniform of a black-shirt sergeant, leapt from the seat beside the driver and dropped on one knee in the roadway, with a bulky camera at the ready, to capture the moment when the figure in the wide rear seat of the Rolls should descend. Count Aldo Belli adjusted his black beret carefully, sucked in his belly, and rose to his feet as the driver scurried around to hold open the door. The Count smiled. It was a smile of flashing white teeth and powerful charisma. His eyes were dark and romantic, with the sweeping lashes of a lady of fashion. His skin was lightly tanned to a golden olive, and the lustrous curls of his hair that escaped from under the black beret shone in the sunlight. Although he was almost 35 years of age, not a single grey strand adulterated that splendid mane. From his commanding position, his height was exaggerated, so he seemed to tower godlike above the men who scampered about him. The highly polished cross-straps glittered across his chest, as did the silver death's head cap badges. The short regimental dagger on his hip, set with small diamonds and seed pearls, was to the Count's own design, and the ivory-handled revolver had been hand-made for him by Beretta. The holster was belted in tightly to subdue a waistline that was showing signs of rebellion. The Count paused and glanced down at the little sergeant. "Yes, Gino?" he asked. "Good, my Count. Just a little up with the chin?" The Count's chin caused them both much concern. At certain angles it showed an alarming tendency to duplicate itself like the ripples on a pond. The Count threw up his chin sternly, rather like Il Duce, and the gesture ironed out the jowls below. "Bellissimo!" cried Gino, and tripped the shutter. The Count stepped down from the Rolls, enjoying the way the soft, sparkling leather of his high boots gave like the bellows of a concertina above his instep as he moved. And he hooked the thumb of his gloved left hand into the belt above his dagger as he flung his right arm up and outwards in the fascist salute. "The General awaits you, Colonel," Crespi greeted him. "I came the moment I received the summons." The captain made a moue. He knew the summons had been delivered at 10 o'clock that morning, and it was now almost 3 in the afternoon. The Count's primping had taken most of the day, and now he glowed from bathing and shaving and massaging and smelled like a rose garden in full bloom. "Clown," thought the captain again. It had taken Crespi 10 years of unswerving service and dedication to reach his rank. While this man had opened his purse, invited Mussolini for a week of hunting and carousal to his estates at the foot of the Apennines, and had in return been given the colonelcy of a full battalion, the man had never fired a shot at anything larger than a boar, and until 6 months ago had commanded nothing more formidable than a squad of accountants, a troop of gardeners, or a platoon of strumpets to his bed. "Clown," thought the captain bitterly. bowing over the hand and grinning ingratiatingly. "Have your photograph taken swatting flies in the Danakil Desert, or sniffing camel dung beside the wells of Chaldi?" he thought, and backed away through the wide doors into the relative cool of the administrative building. "This way, Colonel, if you would be so kind." General De Bono lowered the binoculars through which, with brooding disquiet, he'd been studying the Ethiopian massif, and almost with relief turned to greet the colonel. "Caro," smiled the general, extending both hands as he crossed the uncarpeted, hand-painted tiles. "My dear Count, it is so good of you to come." The Count drew himself up at the threshold and flung the fascist salute at the advancing general, stopping him in confusion. "In the services of my country and my king, I would count no sacrifice too dear." Aldo Belli was stirred by his own words. He must remember them. They could be used again. "Yes, of course," De Bono agreed hurriedly. "I'm sure we all feel that way. General De Bono, you have only to command me." "Thank you, caro mio. Better a glass of Madeira and a biscuit first," suggested the general. "A little sweetmeat to take away the taste of the medicine." The general felt very bad about sending anyone down into the Danakil country. It was hot here in Asmara. God alone knew what it would be like down there. And the general felt a pang of dismay that he'd allowed Crespi to select anyone with such political influence as the Count's. He would not further insult the good Count by too hurriedly coming to the business in hand. "I hope that you might have had the opportunity to hear the new production of La Traviata before leaving Rome." "Indeed, General, it was fortunate enough to be included in the Duce's party for the opening night." The Count relaxed a little, smiling that flashing smile. The General sighed as he poured the wine. "Ha! This civilized life, so far a cry from this land of thorns and savages." It was late afternoon before the general had steeled himself to approach the painful subject of the interview, and, smiling apologetically, he gave his orders. "The wells of Chaldi," repeated the Count, and immediately a change came over him. He leapt to his feet, knocking over the Madeira glass, and stowed majestically back and forth, his heels cracking on the tiles, belly sucked in and the noble chin on high. "Death before dishonour!" cried Aldo Belli, the Madeira warming his ardour. "I hope not, caro," murmured the general. "All I want you to do is to take up a guard position on an untenanted waterhole." But the Count seemed not to hear him. His eyes were dark and glowing. "I am greatly indebted to you for this opportunity to distinguish my command. You can count on me to the death." The Count stopped short as a fresh thought occurred to him. "You will support my advance with armor and aircraft?" he asked anxiously. "I don't really think that will be necessary, caro," the general spoke mildly. All this talk of death and honor troubled him, but he did not want to give offense. "I don't think you will meet any resistance." "But if I do?" the count demanded with mounting agitation, so that the general went to stroke his arm placatingly. "You have a radio, caro. Call on me for any assistance you need." The Count thought about that for a moment and clearly found it acceptable. Once more the patriotic fervour returned to the glowing eyes. "Ours is the victory," he cried, and the general echoed him vigorously. "I hope so, caro. Indeed I hope so." Suddenly the Count swirled and strode to the door. He flung it open and called, "Gino!" The little black-shirted sergeant hurried into the room, frantically adjusting the huge camera that hung about his neck. "The general does not mind?" asked Aldo Belli, leading him to the window. "The light is better here." The slanting rays of the dying sun poured in to light the two men theatrically as the Count seized De Bono's hand. "Closer together, please. Back a trifle, General. You are covering the Count." "That is excellent. Chin up a little, my Count. Ha! Bello!" cried Gino, and recorded faithfully the startled expression above the general's little white goatee. The senior major of the Black Shirt Africa Battalion was a hard professional soldier of 30 years' experience, a veteran of Vittorio, Veneto and Caporetto, where he had been commissioned in the field. He was a fighting man, and he reacted with disgust to his posting from his prestigious regiment in the regular army to this rabble of political militia. He protested at length, and with all the power at his command, but the order came from on high and from divisional headquarters itself. The divisional general was a friend of Count Aldo Belli and owed favours. He also knew the Count intimately and decided that he needed a real soldier to guide and counsel him. Major Castellani was probably one of the most real soldiers in the entire army of Italy. Once he realised that his posting was inevitable, he'd resigned himself and settled to his new duties, whipping and bullying his new command into order. He was a big man, with a close-cropped skull of grey bristle, and a hound-dog, heavily lined face, burned and eroded by the weathering of a dozen campaigns. He walked with the rolling gait of a sailor or a horseman, though he was neither, and his voice could carry a mile into a moderate wind. Almost entirely due to his single-handed efforts, the battalion was drawn up in marching order an hour before dawn. 690 men, with their motorized transports, strung out down the main street of Asmara. The lorries were crammed with silent men, huddling in their greatcoats against the mild morning chill. The motorcycle outriders were sitting astride their machines, flanking the newly polished but passengerless Rolls-Royce command car, with its gay pennants and its driver sitting lugubriously at the wheel. A charged sense of apprehension and uncertainty gripped the entire assembly of warriors. There had been wild rumours flying about the battalion for the last 12 hours. They'd been selected for some desperate and dangerous mission. The previous evening, the mess sergeant had actually witnessed the Count, Colonel Aldo Belli, weeping with emotion as he toasted his junior officers with the fighting slogan of the regiment, "Death before dishonour," which might sound fine on a bellyful of Chianti, but left a hollow feeling at 5 in the morning on top of a breakfast of black bread and weak coffee. The 3rd Battalion was in a collectively sombre mood as the sun came up in a blaze of hot scarlet, forcing them almost immediately to discard the greatcoats. The sun climbed into a sky of burning blue, and the men waited as patiently as oxen in their traces. Someone once observed that war is 99% boredom and 1% unmitigated terror. The 3rd Battalion was learning the 99%. Major Luigi Castellani sent yet another messenger to the colonel's headquarters a little before noon, and this time received a reply that the Count was now actually out of bed and had almost completed his toilet. He would join the battalion shortly. The major swore with the practice of an old campaigner and set off with his rolling swagger down the column to quell the mutinous mutterings from the half-mile-long column of canvas-covered lorries sweltering in the midday sun. The Count came like the rising sun itself, glowing and glorious, flanked by 2 captains and preceded by a trooper carrying the battle standard, which the Count had personally designed. It was based on the eagles of a Roman legion, complete with shrieking birds of prey and dangling silken tassels. The Count floated on a cloud of bonhomie and expensive eau de cologne. Gino got a good few shots of him embracing his junior officers and slapping the backs of the senior NCOs. At the common soldiers he smiled like a father and spurred their spleens with a few apt homilies on duty and sacrifice as he strode down the column. "What a fine body of warriors," he told the major. "I am moved to song." Luigi Castellani winced. The colonel was frequently moved to song. He'd taken lessons with the most famous teachers in Italy, and as a younger man he had seriously considered a career in opera. Now he halted and spread his arms, threw back his head, and let the song flow in a deep ringing baritone. Dutifully, his officers joined in the stirring chorus of La Giovanezza, the fascist marching song. The colonel moved slowly back along the patient column in the sunlight, pausing to strike a pose as he went for a high note, lifting his right hand with the tip of a second finger, lightly touching the thumb, while the other hand grasped the bejeweled dagger at his waist. The song ended, and the colonel cried, "Enough! It is time to march! Where are the maps?" And one of his subalterns hurried forward with the map case. "Colonel, sir," Luigi Castellani intervened tactfully, "the road is well signposted, and I have two native guides." The count ignored him and watched while the maps were spread on the glistening bonnet of the rose. "Ah!" He studied the maps learnedly, then looked up at his two captains. "One of you on each side of me," he instructed. "Major Vito, you here. A stern expression, if you please, and do not look at the camera." He pointed with a lordly gesture at Johannesburg, 4,000 miles to the south, and held the pose long enough for Gino to record it. Next, he climbed into the rear seat of the Rolls, and standing, he pointed imperatively along the road towards the Danakil Desert. Mistakenly, Luigi Castellani took this as a command to advance. He let out a series of bull-like bellows, and the battalion was galvanized into frantic action. Like one man, they scrambled into the covered lorries, took their seats on the long benches, each in full marching order with 100 rounds of ammunition in his bandolier and a rifle between his knees. However, by the time 690 men were embarked, the colonel had once more descended from the Rolls. It was an unfortunate chance that dictated that the Rolls should be parked directly in front of the casino. The casino was a government-licensed institution, under whose auspices young ladies were brought out from Italy on 6-month contracts to cater to the carnal needs of tens of thousands of lusty young men in the womanless environment. Very few of these ladies had the stamina to sign a renewal of the contract, and none of them found it necessary. Possessed of a substantial dowry, they returned home to find a husband. The casino had a silver roof of galvanized corrugated iron, and its eaves and balconies were decorated with intricate cast ironwork. The windows of the girls' rooms opened onto the street. The young hostesses, who usually rose in the mid-afternoon, had been prematurely wakened by the bellowing of orders and the clash of weapons. They traipsed out onto the long second-floor veranda, clad in brightly coloured but flimsy nightwear, and now entered into the spirit of the occasion, giggling and blowing kisses to the officers. One of them had a bottle of iced Lacrima Christi, which she knew from experience was the colonel's favourite beverage, and she beckoned with the cold, dewed bottle. The colonel realised suddenly that the singing and excitement had made him thirsty and peckish. "Hey, cup for the stirrup, as the English say," he suggested jocularly, and slapped one of the captains on the shoulder. Most of his staff followed him with alacrity into the casino. A little after 5 o'clock, one of the junior subalterns emerged, slightly inebriated, from the casino, with a message from the colonel to the major. "At dawn tomorrow, we advance without fail." The battalion rumbled out of Asmara the following morning at 10 o'clock. The colonel was feeling liverish and disgruntled. The previous night's excitement had got out of hand. He'd sung until his throat was hoarse, and he'd drunk great quantities of Lacrima Christi before going upstairs with two of the young hostesses. Gino knelt on the seat of the Rolls beside him, holding an umbrella over his head, and the driver tried to avoid potholes and irregularities in the road, but the count was pale, and his brows sparkled with the sweat of nausea. Sergeant Gino wished to cheer him. He hated to see his count in misery, so he attempted to rekindle the warlike spirit of yesterday. "Think on it, my count. We of the entire army of Italy will be the very first to confront the enemy, the first to meet the bloodthirsty barbarian with his cruel heart and red hands." The count thought on it, as he was bidden. He thought on it with great concentration and increasing nausea. Suddenly he became aware that of all the 360,000 men that comprised the expeditionary forces of Italy, he, Aldo Belli, was the very first, the veritable point of the spear aimed at Ethiopia. He remembered suddenly the horror stories he'd heard from the disaster of Adowa. One of the atrocity stories outweighed all the others. The Ethiopians castrated their prisoners. He felt the contents of that noble sack between his thighs retracting forcibly, and a fresh sweat broke out upon his brow. "Stop!" he shrieked at the driver. "Stop this instant!" A bare 2 miles from the centre of the town, the column was plunged into confusion by the abrupt halt of the lead vehicle, and, answering the loud and urgent shouts of the commanding officer, the major hurried forward to learn that the order of march had been altered. The command car would take up station in the exact centre of the column, with 6 motorcycle outriders brought back to ride as flank guards.